We're going out after the white whale again. Let me just briefly tell you what's coming up the rest of the week. I mean, this, in a way, Moby Dick is a culminating work. We are going to look at some other O'Connor short stories, but even those short stories don't have quite the immensity of Wise Blood and A Good Man is Hard to Find. So the next couple of days will be a little calmer for you, okay? But nevertheless, the stories are superbly done, well worth reading, and there is much to say about them. Tomorrow morning, Lieutenant Childs will be talking about Good Country People at 9 o'clock. So if you would read that, Good Country People. And at 11 o'clock, I'll be talking about Everything That Rises Must Converge. So those two stories. And then Friday morning, we will end the book camp with a very great piece of Catholic art, proving that Catholic art still exists in our time. And that's O'Connor's short story, A Temple of the Holy Ghost. So that will be on Friday morning. So after this three O'Connor short stories, we'll wrap things up for us. Obviously, and I tried to make the point last week in introducing you to Moby Dick, much of the beginning of Moby Dick is very funny, extremely funny. The opening scenes with Ishmael, the sense of Ishmael as a naive narrator, someone who doesn't really know what's going on, doesn't see what's around him, who gets himself into predicaments he doesn't understand, the uproariously funny scenes of him finding himself sharing a bed with a cannibal. There is great humor at the beginning of this book. It is possible to put great comedy and serious ideas together, but it takes a master artist to do it. It's difficult to do. Melville manages it. But it's fair to say that there is a moment in the novel when it just isn't funny anymore. I have a friend, who commented on one of the great questions about Shakespeare is King Lear. The great comic figure, the fool, disappears halfway through the play. And there's been a great deal of commentary as to why Shakespeare just removed this character at one point in the play. And I have a friend who said quite simply and quite wisely, because the play isn't funny anymore. And therefore, you get rid of the comic character. The comic character has to go because it's not funny. That happens in Moby Dick. There comes a point, and it's fairly early on, when the book isn't funny anymore. And the book stops being funny the moment Ahab appears. We still get a couple small little comic scenes after that. Stubb eating his dinner. There are a few little moments in there. But the kind of genuine comic vision that we have at the opening when we haven't shoved off yet, when we're still in port, that vanishes. And nothing like it comes again. In one sense, we can say, even in terms of the style of the book, Ahab dominates. We seem to be moving along one kind of novel, which is going to be serious, though, with great comic scenes, but Ahab appears and that is all swept away. Ahab overwhelms this book. Ahab steps into this book and takes charge. This makes sense because Ahab is the grandest creation in all of American literature. There's nobody else in any other book that can begin to match the size, the power, the scope, the vision of this single character. And it's appropriate that, since we do have a conflict in this book, and a huge conflict, the book is not called The Tragedy of Ahab. Ahab is given a worthy opponent. Ahab takes on all of nature. Ahab takes on all of the cosmos. Ahab, and I'll try to show this morning, takes on God himself, although a false God, in the person of the whale. So that we have a character who is battling against everything. The social order in which he finds himself. The natural world into which he has been born. The structure of the universe itself, and a conception of God and that God that was given to him as a young man. The only God he has ever known. And Ahab is out after all of that. But of course, given that opponent and opponents an opponent of that size, magnitude, it's not surprising that the opponent wins, and the book is named Moby Dick. The book is named for the whale, not the captain. It's not the case of having a great tragedy of Captain Ahab. It may be that, and I'll try to make that claim, that Ahab is indeed a tragic figure. And as I said last week, it's one of the things that those of us who are Americans can be very proud of, is that our country did indeed produce a great tragedy. It's a rarity. It's a very, very rare thing. It's only happened a handful of times. Ironically, that in the 19th century, great tragedy should be produced in two spots. The United States, one immense tragedy, and of course in Russia, with the writings of Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. And that those two countries should rise up, and I suspect that confrontation is not quite over yet, despite what you read in the press. In any case, that tragic vision is in Moby Dick. Melville gives us that vision, but the tragic figure is Ahab. Now, he knows what he's doing insofar as I want to go back to the source of the name. And Melville names his characters quite deliberately throughout this novel. He takes the name from 3 Kings. Okay, if you want to go back and read the story of Ahab or Ahab, I guess it would be in the Douay Rheims, Achab, but that's the figure. You can find the story in 3 Kings chapters 16-22. So that Melville knew his Bible and knew it very well. So he has deliberately chosen this name, and he has named his sea captain for a biblical king. Just going to give you a couple of moments from the beginning and the end of that tale, of the biblical account. His father Omri dies. And Omri slept with his fathers and was buried in Samaria, and Ahab, his son, reigned in his stead. Now Ahab, the son of Omri, reigned over Israel in the 8th and 30th year of Asa, king of Judah. And Ahab, the son of Omri, reigned over Israel in Samaria 2 and 20 years. And Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord above all that were before him. Nor was it enough for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Naboth, but he also took to wife Jezebel, daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and he went and served Baal and adored him. And he set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal, which he had built in Samaria, and he planted a grove. And Ahab did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, than all the kings of Israel that were before him. Those are strong words. What Melville has done is chosen the name for a clearly evil man, a man who chooses, if you will, a man who chooses evil, but we have to put it in a particular context. A king of Israel who has defied God. And from the name itself, we get the basic opposition, and that is Ahab is defying God himself. And the name suggests that. Not going to take time to look at the little scene where Elijah, the prophet, stops Ishmael as he's getting on the ship. But it is interesting. It is indeed, again, in these chapters that Elias the prophet appears. And it is Elias who comes to Ahab and directly confronts him with his evil. Magnificent, magnificent stories. And of course, Ahab does not listen. And the prophecy is then given that because of his not just refusal to obey God's will, but his direct antagonism to God, that Ahab will be cut down. And indeed, the prophet Elias says that dogs will lick your blood. And I'm going to the very end. I'm in chapter 22. A big battle, and the king died and was carried into Samaria. And they buried the king in Samaria. And they washed his chariot in the pool of Samaria. And the dogs licked up his blood. and they washed the reins according to the word of the Lord, which he had spoken. So it's all well and good for Ahab to defy God. He's been told what the end will be. He knows what the end will be. The end comes. He is destroyed, and indeed, the dogs come and lap up his blood. And the reason for that is because the word of the Lord had been spoken. It was inevitable. I point out that ending because there is also a sense all the way through this book of inevitability. That we are engaged in a struggle, and from the beginning, there is a sense in this book that we know what that end is going to be. It's fairly clear what that end is going to be. You don't have to be too terribly insightful to figure out that Ahab is not going to conquer that whale, cut him up into nice little whale steaks, put the ambergris on board and go home and collect a big bonanza and retire comfortably with wife and children in the country. You don't have to be too bright to see that we've got another end in view in this work. And indeed, Ahab at many times throughout the novel will talk about the fatedness of what happens. That he is an instrument. He is fated to go out and pursue this whale. There are no two ways about it. He is impelled. He is driven. He cannot stop. Now I'm issuing a warning, and it's this. Those words may make this sound Greek in nature. Like the tragedy of Oedipus, where fate hangs over the work and everything has been decided long before. Ahab will say that at one point. This was all decided long before. But the fact of the novel is, it is what we would call Christian tragedy in spite of the darkness of the vision. Because at any moment, Ahab can choose to go home. At any moment in the novel, Ahab can call off the chase. Ahab is a man possessed of free will. And the fact that the word of the Lord has come to him, in a sense, he knows very well he is not going to overcome that whale, but he chooses to pursue it. It is a matter of free will. It is not simply fated. It is that he is well aware of what's coming and chooses to meet that end, chooses to continue in this pursuit. We'll look at the reasons why, but I want to emphasize that this book is not Greek in nature. There is still enough of the Western Christian tradition here, even though it's being looked at in a very peculiar light, to suggest that what we have here is tragedy. We have a tragic hero who makes a choice, a very clear choice, and that alternative was a real possibility. We'll see some moments when indeed that gets presented. Now, I want to start out this morning, that's all by way of background. I want to start out this morning where I left off last time. In terms of going through the book and looking at the book, I just reached the point where they were about to ship out to sea. And I had spoken about the two captains who owned the ship. The ship is called the Pequod. As we mentioned in the discussion, the ship is named for an Indian tribe that was wiped out by the Puritans when they came to New England. It was a bloody massacre, and none of them were left. So that from the beginning, the very ship looks back to a bloody time in American history. The name of the ship drips blood, if you will. And it drips a particular kind of blood. It drips a blood of those who come with a vision and a vengeance. So again, it is appropriate that this ship named the Pequod should be Ahab's ship. However, Ahab is not the owner of this ship. The ship is owned by those two Quaker captains, Bildad and Peleg. Last time I went over their little scam, I went over the little game they play, in which they get sailors to sign on for very little money. And it's done, one of them sits there, and reads the biblical verses about don't store up riches on the earth, while the other is running the negotiations. It's a great con game. It's a con game that works. But what we have here, in terms of the owners of the ship, and an understanding that they pass to their captain, and there's a reason they've chosen their captain, is one aspect of the American vision that defines us almost completely. If we've got what the book will call fighting Quakers, what I called a kind of schizophrenia at the heart of this American novel, and a schizophrenia at the heart of who we are, one half of that schizophrenia, pretty clearly, is materialism. Those Quakers are not fighting for any kind of grand moral vision or high ideal or principle. If they are fighting Quakers who are bathed in blood, they are fighting for money. And it is that, ultimately, that will drive them. The fact of the matter is, for some of these same Quakers are the most sanguinary of all sails and whale hunters. And they are whale hunters in a different way from Ahab. The owners of the boat who send out the boat don't care about a particular whale. Theirs is not a vision of vengeance in that way. They care about all whales, as many whales as possible. They intend to make a few bucks. I want to look at two different ideas, and this leads us into one of them, to try to define the book from two different perspectives. Both of them ultimately focus on Ahab. I know many of you know Dr. John Rowell, who teaches history, a brilliant historian. Had seen this pamphlet. I'd read parts of it. I picked it up downstairs last week. His little pamphlet on Americanism. If you don't know it, grab it, read it. It's brilliant. It's an extraordinary piece of work. As I was reading through it and putting together the talks on Moby Dick, I was suddenly hit between the eyes with parallels between his analysis of American history, that is a historian's perspective on American history, and what we get from an artist's view in Moby Dick. The two connect in ways that are too overwhelming to be ignored. And I would say, I don't know. I mean, I know Dr. Rao. I don't think he knows Moby Dick terribly well. My point being, I don't think the book influenced what he was writing. He's a historian. I suspect he's read Moby Dick. I'll have to find this out. But his remarks go right to the core of what this book is. The first part of his discussion, and that's what I'm going to focus on, is called Patriotism and the American Soul. And I'm going to make the claim that in the character of Ahab, we have a depiction of the American soul. We have an artistic depiction of the soul. We get a vision of a particular character. Here we have a historical analysis of the same. Dr. Rao makes the point that there are two streams that feed into Americanism. There are two separate streams that define the American soul, and they are in many ways contradictory. Again, leading towards what can only be called a kind of schizophrenia that is at the basis of this land of ours. The first, as he says, has to do with something that comes from the Anglo-Saxon tradition, specifically from England. And that is a part of our tradition that seeks for material comfort in the home. That is, there is a vision, and it is indeed part of what defines and makes that particular country so attractive. We were talking yesterday, Father Ascara was admitting to a love of England. Having a great love for Italy, he went to England for the first time, and there is that there that is extraordinarily attractive, and much of that attraction has indeed to do with the livable nature of the life. It's a comfortable life. It's a good life. It is a life, you know, the vision of the cottage. of the little village is there and workable. But there is a price to be paid for that. I'm reading from Dr. Rao's pamphlet. It is no accident that the Protestant Revolution in England created the Anglican Church and the Via Media, the Middle Way, with its attempt to combine the new religion with much of the old. Okay? That is, giving up on the Catholic faith, becoming Protestant, but still having attractions to certain things that that old religion offered and not willing to chuck it completely. One ought not to be surprised that the Enlightenment in Britain did not give birth to political chaos, but rather to an effort to modify Christianity and establish that liberal Protestantism which masquerades a loss of faith behind outwardly traditional forms. There is little mystery to the fact that English philosophers have often been anti-philosophers, in the sense that they have sought to demonstrate that ideas have no intrinsic meaning, and the whole philosophical enterprise is simply a word game. He goes on to say that, as a result, the English have done much better in the area of literature than they have in philosophy, because literature, dealing with the details of lived life, is something that they can understand and deal with, whereas if you get into the realm of pure ideas, they are put off by it. So that there was an inbred desire for stability that prevented them from taking themselves or anything else too seriously. That wonderful humor that comes from there. It's a humor we see at the beginning of this book, as Ishmael's about to shove off, okay? That is good humor. It is Ishmael's ability to laugh at himself, particularly in a kind of domestic setting. When he goes to the inn, when he tries to find a place to sleep, when he ends up with a bedfellow, the scene of ordering of chowder, that's where the comedy is. It is particularly domestic. It has to do with day-to-day lived life. What we don't have in the book, particularly in most of the other characters, is any sort of Ishmael does not have big ideas. When Ishmael is developing an idea, it has to do with his own personal whims or what moves him to an act. We get some of it in the beginning of the book as he describes the desire to go down to the sea, to be free from the land, to go off. And we get that adventuring spirit that is a rebellion against the desire to sit at home. If the root of America is rebellion against that king, that English government, we take the domesticity, we set up the nice house, and then the rebellious spirit takes over and we leave it. So it's there, it's back there somewhere, we built it, we have the comforts of home, we have all that represents, and then we realize, gotta move, gotta get out, gotta get up and go, whoom, and up and away, okay? It was the point I made last time about after a life time of work, after establishing the house, after building the garden, after putting up the two-car garage, then grandma and grandpa buy the mobile home and boom, they take to the roads. We have to have another house, a second dwelling, but it's not one, we don't want to be localized, we don't want to be stabilized. There's still life in me. How do I prove I ain't dead yet? I buy my mobile home and I take to the roads, and you can see them zooming up and down Route 61 all the time. There they are, okay? And if you look in the front, it's not young people driving those things. The young people are out there trying to establish their home so that they will have the nice family room and the beautiful living room and the big dining room with the big dining room set and three bedrooms and four baths and two cars and three TVs. And as soon as they get all that and work their whole life and have this, then it's, I gotta get out of here. I gotta go to Florida. I gotta go to Arizona. Let's get in the mobile home and take off to Alaska. That's Ishmael. That's the rebellion against this comfort. But that comfort comes first. If the home isn't there, we can't pull up stakes and leave it. Okay? However, okay, in conjunction with this, you can't have the house, you can't have the two cars, and you certainly can't have the mobile home unless you've got the money. And in conjunction with this vision of comfort. I'm just going to call it the vision of comfort, the American vision of comfort. We get a hot, humid day, and boy, on goes the dehumidifier, on go the air conditioners. Oh, it's agony. God has sent us hot, humid weather. How to get out of it? Okay, this is there is no question as to why air conditioning came from America. There is no question at all as to why air conditioning is fundamentally American. And air-conditioned cars, and, you know, just, I will not be uncomfortable because I have defined my life to a large degree by comfort. I will have four bathrooms in my house. I'm not walking upstairs. There's going to be one right down the hallway, so I don't have to walk up the stairs. That's comfort. And indeed, the toilet seat itself in winter will be heated. Okay? It's out there. You know it. It's there. We're talking comfort carried to an absurd degree. I will not open the door of the refrigerator to get my ice cubes. I will have an ice machine in the door of my refrigerator, and I'll stick the glass under it, and the cubes will drop into the glass, ready-made. I don't have to go fill up the ice cube trays. I don't have to put them in the refrigerator. I don't have to open the door to get the ice out. All this will be done for me because I am an American, and this is what I have earned. I have earned the comfort of ready-made ice cubes coming from inside the refrigerator to me in the glass, and I do nothing. No other country on earth could dream of carrying comfort to such absurd ends, okay? I could go on for the next hour and a half and just give you more examples. Let me just say, create your own. Create your own. You know them. You live in this world. It is a world of solid comfort, okay? And that comfort demands money. I can get a little simple old ice box, and it will keep the milk cold, and it will keep the meat from spoiling. But if I want that ice box that makes its own ice cubes for me, it's going to take stash. I need money. Because the people who are building this device for me are not going to give it to me on the cheap. And therefore, I must, if I am going to have this comfortable life I deserve, make money. So that Bildad and Peleg, the owners of the Pequod, are sending out their boat and cheating the crew because they want cash. They will fish the oceans bare if necessary and slice up all the whales and drain nature dry. But there's a reason for that, and the reason is they deserve their comfort. They're Americans. And the one thing that will not intrude on that is any kind of idea. Don't start talking abstract reasons to me about why I'm a fighting Quaker, about why is a Quaker, a peace lover, one who believes that God is reflected in all things in nature, I shouldn't be out there slashing up whales savagely and turning that spilled blood into cat. Don't talk to me about that. I'm not interested. I'm sitting here reading my Bible. And my Bible is an excuse to make more money for myself. Fact of the matter is, what the scene shows us, those captains don't take the ideas in the Bible seriously. The Bible becomes an excuse to make more money. Now, this land of material comfort was offered to everyone. We were an immigrant land. And the fact of the matter is, with all of these different peoples coming in, there had to be a way of integrating them all. I quote Dr. Rao again. American conservatism gave birth to movements that tried to keep these masses out. They did not succeed in their efforts. The only other alternative, given the innate national drive towards stability, not just comfort, but stability, okay, where we're all in this together, seemed to be the adoption of a policy of rapid integration. If unity could not be assured by closing down the borders, harmony might still prevail by churning immigrants through an Americanizing process. So they may be coming from Italy and Ireland and Norway. They may be coming from Germany and Jamaica and Uruguay, but they're all coming in and they're going to be Americanized, okay? They're going to end up one thing. In the same way that we can take any number of different kinds of cheese, put it through the process, and I'll get American cheese, which is noted for its blandness and lack of taste. But in order to do that, I have to melt down the initial stuff and turn it into something else. How was this task accomplished? In two ways. First of all, negatively, by subtly teaching the immigrant peoples what they could not do in the United States. Thus, they were shown that controversial issues, disturbing stability, such as those touching upon religion, were out of place in the American forum. You don't talk about this religion stuff. Because if you start doing it, the Norwegians and the Italians are going to be pounding each other's heads in because they have two entirely different visions. Therefore, it's live and let live. We'll all get along. There's only one way to do that. You don't talk about any of it. We're back at Ishmael, okay? We're back at Ishmael confronting Queequeg with Yojo and saying, well, the most important thing is that we all get along. Yes, he's worshiping this idol, but I guess what I really need to do is I'll bow down and worship the idol too. I don't care. As a good Christian, and that means really a good American, not going to fight any of that. I'm a good devout Presbyterian, but you know, I'm not going to get into a quarrel about this because the most important thing, we're back to that niceness, is do we get along? And therefore, in order to get along, yeah, I'll worship an idol. God would want me to, because I need to be nice to my fellow man. The Constitution had already begun this process when its awareness of religious diversity caused it to abandon the concept of an established church. Could not have. If you had an established church, it would simply create havoc in the land. Secondly, it was also accomplished in a positive manner by discovering a goal toward which all Americans, regardless of their way of life, could strive. Here it is. Now, let me just do it this way. I don't have a lot of time. Let me describe it this way. We get the crew together and we'll take anybody on board. The Pequod is a model of diversity, a model of ethnic diversity. I do have a colleague who objects to the book because there are no women on the Pequod. So I guess Melville wasn't quite as far-reaching in his vision as he should have been. He was a troubled and thoughtful man. He wasn't mad. But he created a character who was mad, and Melville knew where such obsessions could lead. Let me just look at the three whaling boats, the three main boats that go out when they actually sight a whale, okay? Now we have Ahab who's basically in charge, but I'm talking about Starbuck, Stubb, and Flask. We've got Starbuck Starbuck is the good, decent American man. It's as simple as that. It's the reason he's first mate. It's very tough. There are things lacking in Starbuck, quite honestly, but the decent guy you'd want by your side. He has no vision. Sadly doesn't believe in it. He certainly has no belief to counter the captains, and we'll see that in a moment. But he's a decent guy. And behind him, backing him up, is harpooner Queequeg, the tattooed cannibal, who's a prince in his own land, okay? This is a curious boat, these two men together. We take the second boat, Stubb. And behind Stubb is Tashtego, who is the American Indian. Stubb is really just the representative of that world of comfort. I won't go through the scenes. When you read the book, look, Stubb is funny. Stubb is the comedy, in a sense, on the boat. We get a good bit of comedy with Stubb. And what Stubb likes is his creature comforts. His creature comforts. And he doesn't want them destroyed. I'll look at one scene in just a moment with him. and behind him, Tashtego, the Indian. The one, curiously, on whom this land of comfort was built. But we'll let him on the boat. There's a place for him on the boat. And we will use him for his strength, his vision, and he's got a good arm and he can throw a fine harpoon. And in the third boat, we've got Flask. These names are wonderful, by the way. I'm not pausing. Starbuck, Stub, and Flask. Tells everything you need to know about them. Flask goes beyond creature comfort. He's breathing. He's there, but that's about all we can say. Flask is one of those creatures whom creature comfort is just reduced to a state of being, I guess, but beyond that. And behind him, Dagu, the black African, okay? And being in these three boats, you have a magnificent vision of diversity. You have a vision of that integration that is America. But what brings them together? What makes it possible for men of such distinct and diverse backgrounds to come together on one ship to go out in pursuit of one object? Well, first of all, they're doing it because they're being paid. And they're not being paid much, but the owner of the ship, who have bought the ship and rigged the ship, are giving them enough so they have a purpose. When they come back, they can have comfort if they want. They can participate in that land of comfort. Although we have seen the second aspect of that. Lieutenant Childs mentioned that it's a magnificent chapter that goes by quickly. Bulkington, the guy who just gets back from the four-year voyage, and Ishmael can't believe he sees him. He's booked on the Pequod. He's heading out again. Because there is that in some Americans that just will not settle, will not take comfort. It's that rebellious spirit again. It's got to fight that at every moment. And there is that in all of these characters. There is that spirit of rebellion. I won't sit home. I'm going out. I'm doing something exciting. And you better give it direction, so let's send it whaling. Let's send it out whaling. And we give them all, okay, a goal towards which all Americans, regardless of their way of life, could strive. They have to have an external goal. Okay? Maybe we can give it a kind of abstract name. We can call it democracy. We can call it equality. We can call it liberty, but we really don't want to define those things. And if we start talking about those ideas and defining them exactly, then I'll fall asleep or go turn on the TV and watch Mr. Ed reruns and eat Cheetos. Because I really don't want, I believe in democracy. What do you mean by that? Well, you know what I mean. Everybody knows what it is. Don't bother me. Seinfeld's coming on, okay? And that's, I don't want to talk about that stuff. I know what it means. You know what it means. That's a given. Equality, we know what equality is. We're all equal here. We're all equal, and what do you mean by equality? Equality in what sense? Equality before God? Don't talk about God. Don't you believe in God? Of course, we all believe in God. I'm a good American Christian. I believe in God. Don't bother me. I gotta go out and polish up the speedboat. Mrs. and me, we're going out in the water tomorrow. We're going fishing. New boat. Nice boat. I gotta sit before we take it out. But you get them out there and you give them a goal. Let's go whale hunting. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We'll go out and take big harpoons and boom, hit the whales. Yeah. Good. Blood killing adventure excitement. There's a whale. Yes, come back. Okay. We'll give you some of the money. Not much, but most. Okay. Now, there's the vision. There's the vision. So, two things. Comfort that one can rebel against, but nevertheless, it's got to be there. It's one of the two things. You've got to have that vision of comfort. Home. But not home in a metaphysical sense of a lived life in society, home, mine. Don't you come in. My backyard, fenced off. Okay? My TV, my VCR, my car. My barbecue, my boat. And if I decide to share it with you, then I'll let you participate briefly. But no, you know, it's the Robert Frost poem. Frost is a great poet. Good fences make good neighbors, and there's New England for you. We can be really good neighbors, but we better build a good fence, and we better go out regularly and make sure that fence is still up. Because if that fence starts falling down and your cows start browsing or grazing in my pasture, we're not going to be good neighbors anymore. Okay? If I find out your kids are going over and stealing apples from my apple trees, we're not going to be good neighbors anymore. Because, oh, well, we share the same vision. We're good Americans. We believe in democracy and liberty and freedom and equality. Oh, well, don't want to talk about it. Well, we know what that means. Don't have to talk about it. Don't have to talk about it. Besides, the ball game's on. Brewers are ahead, 5-4, but it's a shaky lead. I got to get back on what, you know, I don't have to talk about all that. I'm a good God-fearing man. I believe in God, but I want to talk to you about it because that guy next door, that, you know, he goes to some weird evangelical church. I don't know what it is. I'm myself, Mrs. and me and the kids, we're good Methodists. We go every Christmas, okay? Before we come home and unwrap the gifts. Okay? Common vision. Well, it is. It, you know, common vision. Common vision. Make money. It's mine. Here it is. But also the rebellion against it. The rebellion against it. And one day, Daddy picks up and says, maybe he doesn't even say goodbye. Out the door, gone. You know, and suddenly, what happened to the family? Family's gone. He didn't go whale hunting. That's not a possibility anymore. That whole sense of adventure is... That whole sense of adventure has been closed down in a sense, but at any moment, the American male, and now, thanks to equality, the American female, can just pull up, goodbye, I'm gone, I'm starting a new life, I'm out of here. And it's that spirit of rebellion against the comfort, okay? Now, we have this world of comfort in which dwells the pioneer mentality. Because I can still pull up and go out there. This is how things are set up. Now, I want to look at this in terms of Ahab, who understands all this thoroughly, but finally rejects. I want to look at chapter 30. Very short chapter. One last word quickly about the captains, the owners of the Pequod, recognize the difficulty of holding all these men together. They recognize the difficulty of holding such diverse peoples together and making them go out on one mission. Therefore, they hire not the best captain they can find, not the most decent, upright, solid, dependable one. Starbuck isn't made captain. They hire Ahab. They hire a guy with a vision who will dominate all the others. And eventually what you need the dominating vision. I'll come back to that. But let me just say the owners know enough. The owners of the Pequod, who are the captains, have enough sense to realize they better hire a captain who can completely dominate the crew. So we may have equality. And we may have this sense of we're all one here and we're all out after a common mission. But we better have somebody in charge whose vision is so obsessive, there's no question he's going to maintain control. And they hire Ahab. Ahab gets out to sea. Simple little scene. He's smoking his pipe, okay? He's smoking his pipe. And middle of the chapter. How now this smoking no longer soothes? Oh, my pipe, hard must it go with me if thy charm be gone. Here have I been unconsciously toiling, not pleasuring, I and ignorantly smoking to windward all the while, to windward and with such nervous whiffs as if, like the dying whale, my final jets were the strongest and fullest of trouble. What business have I with this pipe? This thing that is meant for sereneness, to send up mild white vapors among mild white hairs, not among torn iron gray locks like mine. I'll smoke no more. He tossed the still lighted pipe into the sea. The fire hissed in the waves. The same instant the ship shot by the bubble the sinking pipe made. With slouched hat, Ahab lurchingly paced to deck. We've got a man here who is giving up that whole side of American life. Comfort, let it go. Forget it. Forget it. If America can be defined, if half of the American soul is defined by materialism and a refusal, therefore, to deal with serious ideas, beware the man who's not interested in the money and who takes ideas seriously. This is a man who can dominate. I'm in the chapter just before that. I'm backing up now to the very end. Ahab walks the decks constantly. And as I said last week, if you're sleeping below and hear that constant thunk, thunk, thunk of his ivory peg leg on the deck, it's going to make it tough to sleep. Stubb, who is most concerned with his own comfort, and that includes sleep, goes up and suggests that the captain wrap some cotton around his leg. So Stubb is just a doofus. Goes up and confronts the captain and says, "Captain, why don't you just wrap some cotton around that peg leg? Then when you walk, you won't make that much noise, and we'll be able to sleep down below." I love this. "Ah, Stubb, thou didst not know Ahab then." Whoops, big mistake. Here's the response. "Am I a cannonball, Stubb," said Ahab, "that thou wouldst wad me that fashion? But go thy ways, I had forgot. Below to thy nightly grave, where such as ye sleep between shrouds, to use ye to the filling one at last. Down, dog and kennel." I forgot the kind of man I'm dealing with when I deal with you. Go down, sleep your sleep. Sleep your sleep in the shroud to prepare you for your long sleep in that final shroud. Animal seeking comfort, down dog and kennel. "I'm not used to be spoken to that way, sir." "I do but less than half like it, sir." "Avast," gritted Ahab between his set teeth and violently moving away as if to avoid some passionate temptation. "No, sir, not yet," said Stubb emboldened. "I will not tamely be called a dog, sir." "Then be called 10 times a donkey and a mule and an ass and be gone, or I'll clear the world of thee." As he said this, Ahab advanced upon him with such overbearing terrors in his aspect that Stubb involuntarily retreated. That's the only conflict in those two. That's the second mate. They've just headed out on the voyage, and Ahab takes care of Stubb. What? Realizes everything about him, but he also realizes everything else about the crew. Let me end with this. I just have a few minutes left here. Ahab knows these men, and when it comes time to explain to them what it is he's going to do, he knows how to get them, how to hook them. He may have trouble getting the whale. He has no trouble in hooking the crew. I'm in chapter 36, called the quarterdeck. Now, notice this chapter begins with Melville making a link to the previous chapter talking about the pipe. It was not a great while after the affair of the pipe. The one morning shortly after breakfast, Ahab, as was his wont, ascended the cabin gangway to the deck. There most sea captains usually walk at that hour, as country gentlemen, after the same meal, take a few turns in the garden. We have a little hint of that comfort, okay? And the country gentleman walks in the garden in his home after breakfast. The captain walks around the deck. Ahab usually walks around the deck at night. Not the time that gentlemen walk around their gardens. Okay, again, we've got an inversion here. And then, in a sense, something's coming on. Then he shuts himself up within the cabin. Then he paces the deck some more. It drew near the close of day. Sun is setting. This is great. Suddenly, he came to a halt by the bulwarks, and inserting his bone leg into the auger hole there, and with one hand grasping the shroud, he ordered Starbuck to send everybody aft. They all gather, and he suddenly cries out. This is a great scene. "What do you do when you see a whale, men? Sing out for him." "Good," cried Ahab. "And what do ye next, men? Lower away and after him. And what tune is it ye pull to, men? A dead whale or a stove boat? Either we kill the whale or the whale gets us. No middle ground. Okay. More and more strangely and fiercely glad and approving grew the countenance of the old man at every while the mariners began to gaze curiously at each other as if marveling how it was that they themselves became so excited at such seemingly purposeless questions. We have the group. They're all there. And now it takes the man to manipulate them. The man of vision who can begin manipulating them, okay? And all you mastheads have before now heard me give orders about a white whale. Looky, do you see this Spanish ounce of gold? And he pulls out the doubloon. Pulls out the doubloon. It is a $16 piece, man, a doubloon. You see it? Mr. Starbuck, hand me on top mall. While the mate was getting the hammer, Ahab, without speaking, was slowly rubbing the gold piece against the skirts of his jacket as if to heighten its luster. And without using any words, was meanwhile lowly humming to himself, producing a sound so strangely muffled and inarticulate that it seemed the mechanical humming of the wheels of his vitality in him. He receives the hammer, he nails it to the mast, and then, with a high-raised voice, exclaiming, "Whosoever of ye raises me a white-headed whale with a wrinkled brow and a crooked jaw, whosoever of ye raises me that white-headed whale with three holes punctured in his starboard fluke, look ye, whosoever of ye raises me that same white whale, he shall have this gold ounce, my boys." Now, you first give them a vision, we're going whale hunting, but if you really want their attention, pull out the gold and nail it to the mast where they will see it every day. Eye on the prize. Go for the gold, okay? Ooh, and we all get revved up. Who's going to get the gold? Who will get the gold? Who's going to get the big prize? Ahab doesn't care at all. Not at all. But he knows there is only one way to get them to do his bidding, and that's with the promise and the glitter of material. Even if it means they take it back, buy their lovely little cottage, and head out to sea again, which is, again, a kind of basic contradiction. But nevertheless, you become the winner. You become the one who got the gold, okay? He gets them more and more fired up, more and more fired up. And then the voice of reason steps in, who is, of course, always Starbuck. I came here to hunt whales, not my commander's vengeance, says Starbuck. Look, why are we going after one whale? There are a lot of whales out there. So what? We get this one. That means we've missed 20 others. And how much we really get paid depends on how many whales we kill. What are we doing here? How many barrels will thy vengeance yield thee, even if thou gettest it, Captain Ahab? It will not fetch thee much in our Nantucket market. It's Starbuck, the good, decent man of reason, but reason comes down to what? Now, wait. One gold piece, one whale, that's all well and good, but I'm a practical man of business. I'm looking at the bottom line. We spend all that time out chasing this one whale. We're neglecting all the other whales. We won't kill that many. We won't fill our barrels. When will we get back? We won't have that much oil to sell, and therefore we won't make quite as much money. So it's a simple matter of checking the books. Look at the bottom line. Starbuck is a first mate. He has an accountant's mentality. Nantucket market? Hoot! But come closer, Starbuck. Thou requirest a little lower layer. If money's to be the measurer, man, and the accountants have computed their great counting house, the Globe, by girdling it with guineas, one to every three parts of an inch, then let me tell thee that my vengeance will fetch a great premium here. He smites his chest, whispered Stubb. What's that for? Methinks it rings most vast, but hollow. Just vengeance on a dumb brute, cried Starbuck, that simply smote thee from blindest instinct? Madness! To be enraged with a dumb thing, Captain Ahab, seems blasphemous. Starbuck, okay. Bottom line, reason, good, decent man, and now he's beginning to grasp, wait a minute, we got a bigger problem here. This guy's not interesting. This guy's out for vengeance. In fact, he's going to seek vengeance against an animal that happened to bite him? That's crazy. And not only is it crazy, but if he is as insistent as he seems, he's not taking on that one animal. He's taking on the whole natural world. And if you take on the natural world as it was created, you're taking on God. And if you're taking on God, that's blasphemy. Starbuck goes right to the core of it. Starbuck's a thoughtful man. Hark ye yet again, the little lower layer. Ahab begins his retort and says, once again, okay, I have to explain this to you. I'll come down to your level. I'll sink down to your level and explain it to you. And all of a sudden, we break into the second side of the American soul at 11 o'clock.